before I begin to talk about the two chapters that I was assigned, the very last two chapters in the book were new problems, new directions, and the last chapter is falling upward. But I just want to tell you a bit about what I got from reading this book. I was really touched by this book. And the first came from Richard's writing about Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12-step program. And I have really fond memories of going to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings with my family in the when I was in my early 20s. My very wise sister suggested that we do an intervention, what would have been called an intervention. They didn't have them at that time. But she suggested to do that with my dad, who was probably the periodic alcoholic. His drinking had gotten more and more out of control. He was periodic, and so the times between his drinking were becoming more and more. And he lost his job, and our family was in kind of a mess, and our finances were definitely in a mess. And so when we did the intervention, we were so relieved because he said, you know, I think maybe I could try AA again and that would work. And we were so excited about that that we began going to the meetings with him. And it was like no other experience I'd had at that point in my life. It was, it didn't have the awe-inspiring liturgies of the church or rituals. It wasn't that sort of thing. It was more that there was just a raw truthfulness to the people and an integrity and a humanness that really was moving to me. And I had a sense of my own personhood and a sense of acceptance that I hadn't experienced at any retreat or at a church or in school. It touched my soul. You know, it's a lot like Father Jim was talking about a couple of weeks ago when he was telling about that ritual with his father and his brothers and his nephews. The other gift that came to me from the book was Roar's writing on mothers in that chapter on home and homecoming. Kind of at the same time frame as that intervention, my mother didn't work, my sister was married. So with my father losing his job, I was the sole breadwinner, and with a really meager salary. But somehow or other, we were able to keep the wolves from the door until my dad got back on his feet. And I think it was because of that that my father asked me if I would be the one that would pin on his first year pin when he got to 1 year in AA. And, you know, I was absolutely thrilled. I just thought that was so cool. And, I said yes. And funny thing, I never thought about my mom's feelings in this until I read the book. Somehow or other, that came up for me. And because at the time, I was so thrilled, and I patted myself on the back and said, you know, yeah, you did. You stepped up to the plate. You did a good job. And I wanted to share the limelight with him. But I didn't think about my mom's feelings in terms of here she was, the uncomplaining, the steady one for all of us. And she should have had a share in that wonderful, wonderful moment for our family and for my dad. So just those few lines of Richard's writing, I think, for me, caused me to go back and think about how I wanted to let go of any feelings that I had about my mom. I kind of had put her in the category of being I guess a martyr in some ways, and also as unprotecting of my sister and I in terms of our feelings of abandonment. So I had her in a different category, and I thought, you know, let's let go of that. She's been dead for years. And I thought if I could just turn loose of any way that I saw her as being unloving or unaccepting, that in any way would have caused me to feel broken or caused our family to be broken. Both St. Luke and Matthew write in their Gospels not to worry about the speck in our friend's eye, but if we don't see the plank in our own. And so I realized that, you know, if I was going to do that with my mom, to continue the process, I really had to take a look at any pain or hurt or harsh words that I may have said to my mom or to the family that would have caused and added to that brokenness. So I think Richard's words that say we all want to come home metaphorically, you know, to that warmth of that womb of mother really is true. Just rings so true for me. I think of David Rico's image of the Pietà and Mary holding Jesus, you know, without any response, just holding him in love. That's the kind of warmth and womb-like experience that we all long for. So in the past few weeks, I've done some real reminiscing and thinking about my mom and her qualities, and it's been a real blessing for me. So I'm so glad that I had that book to read. And I do think that all events in our lives are worth looking at again and again, not so much to be a revisionist and to rewrite our history, but more to take a look at the many facets, like a diamond, that all have some real clear image of us, of how our lives are and how we interact as individuals with one another and with God. So today I'll be doing some storytelling about things that I think connect with Richard's writing and with scripture. And the point, of course, is not so that you'll know me better, which you may, but more to make the connections of the points, and so maybe to be aware of your feelings and your emotions as I talk, maybe the pictures or the images or memories that come up for you. So that maybe in the second half we can talk a bit about that, what has come up for you in the book and what kinds of meanings. And the other thing I realized is that when Catherine spoke a couple, I think it was 2 weeks ago, she brought up this wonderful question about, you know, who are the mentors and the wisdom figures. I think Richard called them the multipliers. Mm-hmm. You know, who are those people in your life? Who are the people that called you to the second half of life? Another reason that I think stories are so important, at least they are for me and have been a big part of my life, is Tom mentioned that I worked at St. Mark's. I was a pastoral associate and a campus minister for quite a few years. And early on, we saw the chance to begin small Christian communities. And so some of us went to a training. But when we got there, we realized that they really didn't have any books that really fit the university setting, the time frame, and the kind of flow that we had for the quarter system that was out there. But we really wanted to do it because we saw it as a way of student leadership and student development. And so when we realized there were no books, we only had about 3 weeks until the brand new quarter started in the fall. And so rather quickly, the two priests on staff and myself and Maggie Stapp, who was at the bishop's office at the time. Thanks, Tom. Thank you. Yeah, I did bring some up. Thank you. We began to write our own ideas of what the gatherings could be like. And we knew that the important thing was that participants learned to tell their own story. That not so much to get into a Bible study and where it's maybe take them to the past, but keep it in the now, the present, so it was easier to talk about and easier to understand what it was. And, you know, it goes with our tradition, of our oral tradition, of how the early people of the church, that's what we had. We didn't have anything written. It was all oral. So to take it from that standpoint, I know there's some people here that were part of those groups early on when they began, and I know how much you touched the lives of the students to do that, and to be able to have that family dynamic without the baggage. You know, and they were the students often said they were able to talk with these elders without that sort of stuff that they, it was things that they thought they couldn't say to their family. And it seemed to me, yeah, Jim was, that Jim was part of it. It seems to me that they were mirroring exactly what Richard is saying, that it was a part of being elders for these young people. Yeah, Jim.
The adults also got something out of it,
yeah,
because they could relate to the students without the baggage of being parents.
Yeah. So it was a win-win, wasn't it,
yeah,
to have that. And and we saw it also as a way to launch students, you know, onto their spiritual journey if they hadn't had that experience before. So chapter 12 is kind of about that tug and pull between the first half of life and the second half of life, and the difficulties and the solutions that come with that. And Richard writes that the bottom line of the gospel is that probably most of us have to hit some kind of bottom before we can propel into that second half of life and even begin our spiritual journey. And I would say that's true for me. I'm going to tell a story that some of you have heard before, and I hope you'll bear with me or maybe hear it from a new perspective, because I think it's a really good example of that image that Richard gave about the trampoline. You know how someone balances on a trampoline, and sometimes that trampoline just goes almost down and hits the ground before a person is propelled upward. The story I'm going to tell, I see it more as done in slow motion, because sometimes when we hit a snag in life, you know, we don't come right back, and it isn't all very fast and quick. When I was 41, my life seemed pretty good. I was married, and Chuck and I had 5 children, and they were preteens and teenage years, and we were involved with their activities, our activities at the church, and we liked to party a lot, maybe partied a bit too much from time to time. But I wouldn't say we were on a path to doom. You know, we were just on a path that wasn't leading to much of anywhere, you know. So, but during Holy Week that year, I was watching 2 of my neighbors, 8 children, while they were in Hawaii for a week. And the girl drowned in our swimming pool. And it was absolutely tragic. It was, you know, all the pain and suffering that that family went through from losing their youngest child. And I had no clue how to respond to that catastrophic thing. My spirit was broken, and I know I came very close to a breakdown. I thought of I couldn't get out of my mind the pain and suffering of that family, and I was, as Richard would say, I was deeply wounded. Others during this series have talked about St. Paul, the persecutor of the early disciples of Jesus, and how he had a revelation on the road to Damascus. And in this vision, he fell and he was blind for 3 days. My experience seemed that dramatic to me, that for over a year I was just dead inside, and in a lot of ways I just couldn't see. I couldn't make any sense of what happened, and when I tried to talk about it, I would cry. And my husband was so compassionate, and he'd pat me and he'd soothe me and stop me from crying. And it wasn't until, Tom mentioned that we did marriage encounter work, but it wasn't until we went on a weekend that I was able to write about and talk about and have Chuck listen to, you know, the pain and the anguish and the guilt that I was feeling. And I think with that came the beginning of healing and also probably the movement onto the second half of life. I don't think I ever got into that idea that what happened was punishment for some kind of bad deed that I did. But I really was angry with God in a lot of ways, and I wondered about God's wisdom in this, and I had a lot of confusion about how could this happen to a small child, how difficult that is. So I think when we come to big things like this in our life, that we all go through those five stages of grief that Catherine Kubler-Ross writes about. Some people say there's seven. I just know that whatever number it is, recovering from grief takes time and it takes a lot of work. And of course, there's times that we get stuck of, you know, that spiral that they talk about of anger and denial and bargaining and dropping back down to anger again. And you know, sometimes we can get caught in that endless loop of never getting to acceptance. Sometimes it takes a friend or a mentor to come along and to help us get to acceptance of what's happened and to see the bigger picture of maybe what went on with all of this. I like what Richard wrote at the very end of the book. He urging us not to waste a moment lamenting bad parenting or the loss of a job or sexual orientation. You know, that move on with life and don't waste our times with that. And David Rico, that I mentioned a few minutes ago, was here last week talking, and I remember he talked about a time in his life years ago about Mary, and he didn't see that he had much of a relationship with Mary, but then he was walking through his house one day, and he realized that in every room he had some pictures, some image, some statue of Mary. And what he wisely came to from this was that she had more to tell him. And it seems that for us, if we have some event in our life that won't leave us, that it's, we need to take time to let it speak to us again, not to kind of badger us into anger or depression, but to open up the space for insights and understanding in our lives. Eventually what happened for me was that I did begin to see that flow of passion, death, and rising in the day-to-day life, in the large things and in the small. My life, which seemed so worthless at that time, you know, began to have a purpose, and I realized that I could either let this event take me down or it could be a motivation for transformation. So it was a time of real reevaluation realizing that I had to be more aware of all the signs of God in my life all around me. Richard Rohr says that we need time for introspection to unpack all that life has given to us and all that life has taken from us. I wonder how many of you have read St. George and the Dragon and the Quest for the Holy Grail by Edward Hayes. He's a priest writer from the 80s. He's a prolific writer, and he writes prayers and fanciful stories and parables. And this mythic story of St. George and the Dragon came to mind while I was reading this book. And also, Don, when you were talking about the story of Odysseus and his journey to Ithaca, this story is not the classic of the Odyssey, but it's a story that I've loved for years, and so I thought I'd give you a little bit of background on it. George is a middle-class man living in the 20th century, and he thinks he's had the call to go on a spiritual journey and leave his wife and his children. Well, the wife is incensed. She doesn't want him to go, and she thinks he's having an affair. And his boss thinks he's suffering from burnout, and his neighbors think he's mad. But he goes anyway. He goes on this journey, and he gets into the forest, and he finds this huge, very old, very wise Chinese dragon, and he's frightening. But even though he's frightening, when the dragon invites George to climb on for a ride, George does it, and he gets on the dragon's back, and he realizes that the dragon has scales, and the scales have a lot of wounds, a lot of scars, and the dragon explains that the greatest scars and wounds are not from the monsters of the forest, but they actually are from our journeys of life. And he says the wounds come from, you know, parents and brothers and sisters and teachers and strangers. But even though they come from pain and they come from battle, that they're the source, great source of power and insight. And it isn't until we turn these old injuries into glorious wounds that we are fully ourselves. And of course, I think that's one of the main points of Rohr's stories and his book. So I suppose we all have difficult things in our life that have happened, large and small. A divorce that is wanted or unwanted, the loss of a job, the death of someone that we love, a debilitating illness, just growing old sometimes, you know. And then the multitude of other stumbling blocks along the way. But eventually, I think we come to the deeper message. Hopefully, we do. And maybe we don't get it right at the time that some event happens to us, but sometimes we have to be brought to our knees before we see the hand of God that maybe we grabbed onto and held on to for dear life. But I know, too, there's times in my life, and I'm sure in yours, that just grabbing onto that hand is just too terrifying, and we can't do it, and we turn away. Talking with Keith last Friday, and he had a great quote from Kierkegaard that I thought fit in here so well. Simple, but just so profound. Life must be lived forward, but it can only be understood backward. Isn't that just perfect? It says who we are. Life must be lived forward, but it can only be understood backward. If only we could plan ahead and see how it's supposed to be. In Falling Upward, Richard writes about the institutional church and how hard it is to answer the needs of second half of life people. And it brought to mind a group that I just recently reconnected with. Back in the 60s, I was part of a really large parish, and they broke up our areas into what they called guilds, and it was for women. And the idea was that we come together to support each other emotionally and physically and spiritually. And so we'd get together once a month. We all were kind of in the same boat, same neighborhood. We all had kids, a lot of kids. We were just all struggling with some of the same points of life. And it was good. And one of the great things that came out of this group was the fact that somebody had a new child, or somebody was ill, or there was a death in the family, we were there. It was food, or it was babysitting the kids, painting a bedroom, it just was a good support. And they disbanded the groups, and you know, we quit meeting. But recently, the husband of one of the members, the husband died, and so we were all at the funeral and the reception, and we said, why don't we start getting together again? And so we did. And, you know, it was so nice, so good. And we talked and reminisced about, you know, what we'd been to one another in our lives and how good that was. And then someone asked a question about an issue in the church. And one woman said, there will be no talking about religion or politics. And she was very firm about it. And so we all stopped for a minute, and then we went on talking, you know, but we didn't bring up any church issues again. I just thought that was, I would say that we have a double belonging, like Richard talked about, where once we were kind of soulmates, our paths had taken us in another direction. And I grew up in a home like that. That was my mother's rules. No talking about religion or politics at the family gatherings. You know, I'm so sorry because I didn't learn how to do that very well. And I don't think I taught my kids how to do it because I was trying to learn as they were learning. And so now I've got some sons-in-law that just love that sort of thing, you know. And when we're all together, they bring up all sorts of subjects. And still, from my background, I still want to go, be kind to one another now, you know. instead of enjoying, you know, the richness and the diversity, I sometimes think that's maybe how Congress got into such a mess, you know, and the church, you know. They must have all grown up in a house like mine. It's kind of closed-mindedness and this tunnel vision of, you know, if I don't have to listen to or hear what somebody else has to say, then maybe I won't have to change my mind and consider that there's another point of view. When Richard gets into the chapter about both, I think it's chapter 12, dualistic thinking, but he talks about both and first, but then he revisits this dualistic thinking and the idea of who's in and who's out and how easily we compare with good and bad or right or wrong. There's a French philosopher named René Girard who did a lot of writing in the 50s about scapegoating, and more recently Sondra Schneiders, you know, from the Graduate Theological Union, did a masterful writing. I don't know, some of you I know did read it, a five-part article about the visitation of the women religious by Rome. And she talks about this idea of scapegoating. And the whole idea behind the theory is that something in the group is going wrong, and somebody has to take charge or take blame for that. And it can't be us. You know, it's got to be the other, the one over there. That's who's got to be it. You know, that's what Shakespeare plays and Greek tragedies and religious sacrifices are about. And we see it in how we react to skin color and sexual orientation and poor grooming. All sorts of ways that we see it. If when Father Jim was here talking, he brought up Hitler and Nazi Germany. And how did the Holocaust happen when this, you know, they were a country, Germany was a country made up of mostly Catholics and Lutherans? So how did that come about, that scapegoating of the Jews? Martin Luther King was scapegoated because he just wouldn't turn loose of that issue of racism and keeping it before our eyes. And 9/11, we went after a madman who had and went to war. because of weapons of mass destruction. I think we certainly continue to see it in excommunications of politicians who want communion, that maybe make a statement about pro-choice, women who believe that they're called to priestly ordination. Of course, Jesus was the perfect scapegoat. He was from a small town. He was maybe illegitimate. He was
Jewish.
Yeah, in his 30s, and he wasn't married. My grandson Nathaniel is considered by some to be an outsider. I remember when he came to me about 5 years ago, and he told me that he and his wife, the woman he'd been with for 8 years, they were divorcing. And when I asked him why, he said, "I'm gay." And I remember thinking, your life is going to get a lot more tough. Because I don't think, I think we have a lot of fear of gays in our society, it seems to me. For some reason, prejudice and harassment and even bullying, it's not condoned, but somehow it seems to be almost tolerated a bit in our society. 18 years ago, Chuck and I were helped by really good friends whose daughter came out as a lesbian. And we were with them for a part of their time of wrestling with this. You know, what do you do? How do you tell the other part, the other members of the family, the younger kids? Questions were plentiful because we absolutely knew nothing much about being gay, being homosexual, except that the church said that homosexual people were intrinsically disordered and that sexual acts should always be open to life. And did she make the choice? And if she did, why, could she just choose to be straight then? And so as parents, you know, the question was, how do we love her and be kind to her and let her know that she's okay when what she's doing must surely be wrong? Recently, I talked to Nathaniel's husband, Miles, about what he thinks is most difficult for gay, for straight people to understand about gay people. One of the things that he told me baffles him is that when a heterosexual couple talks about their engagement and everybody mostly is excited for them and they talk about their developing relationship and their love and maybe family. But when a homosexual couple talks about their commitment, the first thing that's thought of is sex and the kind of sex that they're having. And probably not about the relationship, and certainly not about family. You probably noticed that I called Miles Nathaniel's husband. They were married last year here in town. I was the minister, and so I had to ask the people attending there if they would write the story of Miles and Nathaniel's love on their hearts and the date of their wedding until I could legally take their certificate to the courthouse so it could be registered, you know, because it is illegal in California. And their ceremony was really touching and very thoughtful as they pledged their love to one another. They had written their own vows, and it's what you would hope for any couple in love that wants to spend their life together. So issues like this come to the forefront of our society rather than hiding in the shadows now. And it seems to me they cause us to think with our second part of life instincts rather than taking on something just from what we're told in the first half of life. And Richard says in his book, now we begin to understand why Jesus is always welcoming the outsider, the foreigner, the sinner, the wounded. He was a second half of life man, and he told us to love one another as I have loved you. Rumi is a Sufi poet, mystic, and one of the things he wrote that struck me about this was, out beyond the ideas of right doing and wrong doing, there's a field. I'll meet you there. Oh, would that we all lived in that field. So in the that last chapter of Falling Upward, he talks about falling becoming standing and stumbling becoming falling. And last month I was at, would have been 58th wedding anniversary for Chuck and I. He died a little over 5 years ago. And a few of us in the family went to the cemetery to take flowers and clean up the grave and to say some words. I hate that cemetery. The ground's uneven and the gravestones are all cattywampus. And, you know, rather than being in a prayerful state, usually I'm grumpy and crabby, and this day was no different. I began to grouse, and the gravesite needed a lot of cleanup, which is evidence that I don't go there very often. It works for me to think of, I know he's not there, you know, it works for me to think that he's more everywhere in this wonderful cosmos we're a part of. But this last time we were sitting around cleaning and thanking Chuck for his legacy, and we said some prayers, and then we began talking, and I was telling him about how we met and our honeymoon and different stories about life. So we kind of did some talking and some laughing and crying. And, you know, as we were doing that, sitting there, I looked around and I looked off and I saw that, yeah, the gravestones were all topsy-turvy, but weren't they the perfect image for the ups and downs of life, you know? The brown grass and the green grass, you know, a lot of the image of life and death. And so that day at the cemetery wasn't so bad. I still don't love it. But Ted Menton writes in After Goodbye, a memory is a poor substitute for the real thing. A memory can't hold you in its arms or fill you with pleasure, or laugh at your jokes, or pitch you a ball, or brag about your cooking, or fight back unfairly, or surprise you on your birthday. I can really identify with that. Death is such a mystery to us, and I know I've said here before, and you've heard me, I think that our society doesn't deal very well with death and dying. How do we connect with that absence and still sense the presence? In the times right after Chuck's death, you know, I was just, my senses were all on alert, and I really could feel Chuck's presence in a lot of ways. And also, I think lots of friends helped keep that grace of his presence alive. But over the years, that does fade, and times of overwhelming grief pass, and we don't feel so cast adrift at sea. So now I think my connection probably with Chuck more comes from contemplation, from meditation. It's not that he's a part of the time, but I think through meditation I get more peacefulness and more of a sense to not sweat the small things and to realize the sunsets and the larger picture of life, so that there is, it does seem like there's more of a oneness of Chuck. It also reminds me that a lot of roads that we have in life aren't roads that we choose.
Yeah.
Like being a widow. It does remind me of we're pushed onto roads sometimes that we don't want to go on. And, but it does remind me of that poem from Robert Frost about the road not taken, where he talks about two roads diverged in the woods, and I took the one less traveled by, and it's made all the difference. You know, so I think from part of that, realizing that there are wonderful times of, I mean, I would certainly never choose it, of being a widow, but, you know, to know that, you know, there is life there, and how are those of us who are in that space, how do we live it? So I want to just go back to Edward Hayes' book for a minute. When George first meets his dragon, Igor, Igor says, "What? Yeah. Who'd have thunk, huh?" So he, Igor says to him, "So what's your title?" And George says, "Well, I don't have a title, unless you know you count Mister." And the dragon says, "No, Mister will never do. You need something bigger, more, something like Sir or St." And George says, "Oh my gosh, no! You know, you could never call me Saint. You know, only the Pope can do that." And he says, Igor says, no, George. St stands for sent. Since the voice is calling you, you are sent." So it seems to me that we are all sent. We're all on our second half of life journey. And we've connected with many of the skills that we need, and we're aware of some that we need to conquer and to hone. So it seems to me that we're kind of in that living out Mary Oliver's question, that marvelous question that she has, you know, tell me what it is I am to do with this one wild, precious life of mine. We're just about to the time break, but I want to tell you about over the years. Yeah, Jim.
I'm not a tremendous fan of Ashley Brilliant. She has a little student in the newspaper. Yeah. But my favorite one says, "When you reach the end of the road, the only thing to do is build more road."
Oh, I like that. I like that. A few times over the years, I've contacted people to be speakers here at the group, and one of the things they often ask is, "Well, what's this group like? You know, who are they, and who is it I'm going to be talking to?" And usually, I tell them, "Oh, we're mostly men." I am so glad to see so many more men here. Thank you for being here and what you bring to the group. But I tell them that we're a bit older and predominantly Catholic, Christian, and that we're mature in our faith. But I tell you that every time I've talked to one of them afterwards, they're absolutely blown away by this group. You know, they just at just the depth of the insights and the enthusiasm and the commitment to a faith journey. And food. Yeah. And the other thing I want to tell you, I was with a group of people last Friday night, and some of them were from here, but there was about 17 of us, I guess, the people from here began to tell the group how precious this group is and how nourishing it is. And it's not just some, who said food? Did you say it, Jenny? Yeah, the food, I mean, you know, how generous we are at the table, but the food for thought that we give to one another and that whole word precious, I thought was really beautiful. But it struck me that, you know, we are Eucharist for one another, and how we feed one another, and and nurture our spiritual journey, that it's hard to find a group where you really sense the presence of Christ so strongly, and that we are the body of Christ for one another. So I think we're probably at a good time.
Eugene has two rules of word in life. Can you tell
me? Oh, what?
Kind of a homily a few while back. I said, Donna said we have no rules. You know, we're very accepting, we're trusting, we're open. So there's actually two rules. One is, when the gong rings, go take your seats and sit down. And the other is, when it's your turn, be sure to bring refreshments.
Any other comments before we take the break? Yeah.
You mentioned the tragedy of that little girl, Patty, and it really nailed me to the floor. But it also caused something else. I can't put my finger on anything of that size happening in my life. Does that mean I still can anticipate that much? Because I don't have, as you can tell, much left, and I don't know whether I could handle anything that dramatic. That's bad.
Or maybe, you know, I don't know, but I
fly by without.
I remember at that time people saying to me, God only gives us what we can handle, and I thought, that's so much bull. So hopefully life has been good and it'll continue to be good.
I wanted to tell you that I have two gay children, and a girl and a boy, and I can't say enough about them. They're such giving people, and I'm a widow, and they have been so wonderful to me, and it's made my life so much fuller, and I tell everybody. So many people have they think because they're gay and somebody has AIDS that God is angry at them, and that's why they have AIDS. And actually, my son is HIV positive, but he is so well. He takes very good care of himself, and you would never know. But I'm thankful.
Yeah.
And my husband always said he was very good at speaking, and so at church he on Father's Day he got up on the altar and talked about him being a father and having a gay son. So it really was wonderful.
Sometimes I want to say we should have a program, Rent a Gay. I truly believe that, you know, till we really know, till it's not an issue, till it's a personal thing, and we know them as human beings, that, you know, then there's not going to be that kind of prejudice. It's just kind of a part of our being. Yeah, Dawn.
There's a way in which Don and I rent a gay, and that is that we like to go on cruises. Now, the population of cruises is not the same as the population of Word and Life. And sometimes, you know, you might have spent 2 or 3 days getting invested in another couple that, you know, you were placed next to in the dining room, only to find out that the rest of the time would be really hard because you have opposite views of everything. So now our strategy is we look for the gays and the lesbians. We've actually gone to lesbian weddings from having formed a really good friendship, you know, with people. And because I think you will never find a person who has come out as a gay or a lesbian person who isn't open to life.
That's great. Well, I see by the clock that we're at time, so take a short break and we'll come back.
Thank you, Harry.